Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. This episode, I have a special guest that's going to join me. It's someone who's been in the comic industry for a really long time. I've known him for quite a few years now, actually. Really great guy, super talented, and just one of my favorite guys to talk to. I'm always happy when I go to a show and I see his name there. I know I'm going to have some good conversation, maybe some good after hours hanging out, having a few drinks. So I'd like to welcome David Barron onto the show. David, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk with you today. And you're right. I think we've had some good shows throughout the years where we had some good drinks and some good conversation.
Yeah, for sure. So for some of our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with your work, give us a quick bio, how long you've been in the industry, maybe some of the more higher profile things that you've done that they may be familiar with.
I started in the industry back in 1994 when I was 15, and since then, some of my highlights included Planetary and Authority with Warren Ellis and Mark Miller and Frank Quitely. I did Green Arrow Year One with Jock and Andy Diggle. Batman the Black Mirror with Jock again and Scott Snyder. Those are the big ones that, you know, I think I sign a lot of. But, you know, I've also been a part of, you know, DC's 52 and a ton of different Batman stories. I think, you know, people really enjoyed Batman the Man Who Laughed with Doug Monkey. That was a highlight. And then, of course, you know, Valiant. I've done Bloodshot Reborn, Divinity, and some of my favorite, Archer and Armstrong, and a new favorite, Valiant High.
And most of your work has been coloring, right? That's what you're most known for?
Yeah, most of my work has been coloring. I have been an art director where I did art direct the World of Warcraft trading card game, and then I also art directed things like the Walking Dead board game, the Big Bang Theory party game, things like that, the DC deck building game. And then I did a little editing on some books here and there, a little this, a little of that, you know, throughout my career, but, you know, design and art direction. But for the most part, people only know me through coloring.
And you've been in the industry such a long time, and you the mid-90s there, right, you know, right before the crash happened, you got your start, and then through this kind of pop culture explosion, it's really, the whole comic industry and landscape has really changed, and you've seen that happen, in my opinion, in a kind of a unique perspective, because you started so young, right?
Yeah, no, it was absolutely unique perspective, mainly because I was a huge fanboy, and you know, I still live in a different way. But, you know, I came in collecting and working at a comic book shop as, you know, at that time I was too young to actually legally work, but I got, you know, odd jobs at a comic book store, like putting flyers on cars at, you know, Debbie's Comics and then helping out another store called Emerald City Comics in La Mesa, California, San Diego area. And so when I came in, you know, I had the luck of being close to the biggest convention, you know, in the United States, San Diego Comic-Con. And with that brought a lot of different opportunities that were unique. And when I got hired, you know, luckily Wildstorm was in San Diego. It was in La Jolla. And so I got to see, you know, during the crash, you know, it affected Wildstorm's sales, but it didn't necessarily affect Wildstorm Comics and as a studio. And then when DC Comics bought Wildstorm, it really didn't affect us. And so when people talk about the crash, you know, what I noticed was the lack of superstars being built. But at the same time, even after that crash, you know, we were still doing, you know, fine. And when Twilight came out and made, you know, San Diego Comic-Con just massive, I was right then, you know, right there for that boom, that growth. So my perspective wasn't as bleak as others, even though I did see others, you know, struggle and have to, you know, figure out if comics is right for them. Luckily, you know, for a lot of people at Wildstorm, you know, we didn't have that same struggle.
Right on. Well, specifically, the reason I have you on the show today is you have a book coming out this Wednesday, which isn't necessarily a rare thing for you, you know, having a book that you worked on come out on a particular Wednesday. but a little different this time, a little different perspective from artist to writer, right? You have Stained coming out from 451 Media, which maybe some of you listening have heard of Michael Bay. So this is his kind of publishing arm. He likes to share stories and kind of dip his toe into the world of comics. So let's talk a little bit before we get into specifics of the story, David. What made you want to tell this story as a writer rather than an artist?
Well, one of the things about me that, you know, a lot of my fans know is I love telling stories even through color. You know, everything about me is always about the story. And throughout my career, when I was young, you know, coloring wasn't something that was a job that really existed. So when I actually showed my portfolio to the people at Wildstorm and other companies when I was young, it was a penciling portfolio. And with the same idea of, you know, writing comics. And I used to write, you know, little tiny stories with, you know, with my buds, you know, back in, you know, sixth grade and seventh grade. And I know that sounds, you know, like, well, that's young. Why is that relevant? Well, because I started as a sophomore in high school, you know, that those moments were, you know, big in my life's time of comics. And so I've always wanted to write, and I you know, did little tiny things here and there. I would hire writers and critique writers when I was an art director. And I actually took that art directing job to be able to do some of my own comics. It just didn't work out with that company I was with. And I just said, you know, if I'm going to write, I got to just do it, because I'm not going to ever find the time. And so what I did is I finally carved out some time to finish my story, because this story has been, you know, written little by little. And, you know, what made me want to tell this one? I wanted to tell this one because I felt it was the most complete story with the most impact to the reader, that showed not only to editors my ability, but to the fans the type of story I would like to read. I believe in the, you know, the thought that you make comics that you want to read yourself. Otherwise, why are you making the comic? And I hold true to that. I try to stay away from projects I don't, you know, enjoy. One of the reasons that, you know, I was drawn to Valiant was I really enjoyed, you know, the stories that they told. And so what made me want to write was it was a burning passion, you know, inside of me for quite a long time. And if I didn't get it out, if I didn't get that creative, you know, outlet out of my system, I think I would have, you know, gone insane. And so it's one of those things where I had several stories and I picked my favorite one that I thought was reachable and would make a really good miniseries, and I went with it. And that's how Stain came to life.
Well, I think a lot of people may be surprised to hear that you've kind of had the story in your back pocket for so long. Being that you are so active in the industry and you know, you're always around, but were you in a way kind of searching for the perfect time and the perfect publisher to kind of put this out?
I was searching for the perfect time, definitely. I mean, the perfect time was any time I could find that would allow me to sit down and write undisturbed. And what happened was when I left my art director job, my transition from comics to art directing was quick, and I had very little time. But I started in that little brief transition writing this book. And what I did was, as soon as I got that art director job, just like everything I do, I had to put my, you know, head down and work really hard at it. And writing kind of took a back seat. And so when I left that art directing job, before I really got back into comics, I wrote a 12-issue story that was called Stained. And it was meant to be ongoing. And I took it around and I got, you know, some people to take a look at it. And the feedback was, no one's going to give you an ongoing, and no one's probably even going to give you a 12-issue run. And because of the climate of comics. And so I retooled that and I wrote a 5-issue mini. And then I got really busy with Valiant Comics. And this is right around Archer and Armstrong number 0 and Shadow Man 0, like in that time period from my first published work from Valiant to Shadow Man 0 was really when I had this project going, and so I kind of worked it out a bit. I, you know, got artists to work with me, and I still got super busy. And then right around Bloodshot Reborn, I would say right when Analog Man went, when I was taking off that book, I had this rare opportunity, and I said, this is it. You know, this is the first time, you know, Valiant has given me that, you know, a huge window in my schedule. It's now or never.
Right.
And I was highly motivated. I thought of the story, you know, for so long, and I said, no, it's now or never. And I made it happen. You know, I found Yusuf Idris, the artist of Stain, through a portfolio search, and I've seen his work, before. And, when I did that, everything just kind of went, because the whole story was already written for him. I gave him a huge 45-day issue, you know, window. I said, you know, let's do this, you know, and he was so excited for it that it kind of happened perfectly. And this was all before a publisher even picked it up.
Now, you find that it's a different process creatively, telling a story as the writer rather than like through setting the tone and the mood with your colors?
Yeah, I mean, with me in writing, I, you know, it probably won't be a surprise to a lot of people who know me. And my writing is pretty controlling. And with that, since I know it's controlling, I also always put in there, you know, feel free to, you know, to improvise if it's not working for you, or, you know, feel free to, you know, chat about this if it's not, you know, something that you find, you know, interesting enough to draw. And with Yusuf, you know, that never happened. You know, he loved every single moment, and he was really excited that he finally had a script that, you know, called out so many great, you know, ideas and concepts. And I think, my process is the only difference between coloring. Coloring, you know, I follow someone else's imagination, and I try to not improve, but I try to understand their motivation and understand what type of story they're trying to tell. And with this one, I get to tell everything. I get to show, you know, the artist what type of story I want to tell. And then I'm also coloring the book, which was not the original plan, but I'm coloring the book. And, you know, so then I get, you know, I get to, you know, kind of tell Yusuf, you know, the direction and the story and the script and everything that I want. And then I get to, you know, color it and be the last person to touch it, just to kind of polish it up, you know, to be the type of book that I want it to be. So the process isn't all that different for me, except that I just have more control now. You know, like, you know, with Bloodshot, let's say Lemire writes this beautiful script, but I don't like one part of it. You know, I'm like, oh, you know, because the fanboy comes out of me. You know, like, oh, he wouldn't say that, or I wish this happened. You know, like, in coloring, you got to go with it. You know, you got to drink the Kool-Aid, and you got to make it look good no matter what. You don't get a say. With writing, it's your words. You get to say, you know, if someone does not like the story, you know, it is 100% me. And, you know, with that said, if they love the story, it's also 100% me. And and with that, you know, the question that you asked just means that the process is a little bit more thorough. You know, there's a little bit more to it.
Now, do you think it would have been different had you not, you said the original plan was not for you to color it. You think it would have been different had you just kind of sent it out into the world, you know, the script, and then got back a finished piece rather than as you said, you're kind of the last hands on it. Did you prefer, do you think you would have rather not colored it?
Well, the whole idea of me not coloring it is because I appreciate so many colorists, talents out there. There's so many colorists that I just am in awe of. And the thing about me being in awe of a colorist kind of means that colorist is pretty busy themselves. So I couldn't find one that could fit the schedule. And that was the toughest part. You know, I mean, obviously it's a self-funded book at that point. So, you know, the pay, you know, isn't the best. I mean, it's not horrible, but it's not the best. And then it has to be someone I, you know, really look up to. I mean, the last thing, you know, I would want to get as a newcomer that, you know, needed a lot of, you know, notes or anything like that, because they would end up hating me at the end of the day. You know, even like a good friend who's a very talented colorist that I've worked with all the time, like Alan Pasalacqua, you know, like he, you know, that guy and I have worked together in the same studio, you know, for years. And I would never, you know, ask him to work with me because he's too close to me. Right. And I would give him way too many notes. He would hate me at the end of the project, and I wouldn't get the best work out of him. So I had a very small list of people that I would be willing just to accept what they do, period. And because I do find that's the key, you know, as controlling as I am over a project, I find it's the key to let them, you know, do what they do. So even though, you know, I would write it and get back a finished project, I'm still was kind of the editor of the project at the same time, in the beginning, where I still had to look at everything. I still, you know, looked at every layout Yusuf did and every ink, and anytime, you know, there was a change, that change came from me, in terms of the artwork. And it was only story based and probably only like a handful of them throughout the issue. Because again, I tried to let Yusuf, you know, shine with what he does, because I believe, you know, you hire someone to do a job and you're supposed to let them do that job. So I try to stay out of it, but yet at the same time, you know, it was an interesting process to get it back and send something back, because I think a lot of people have a hard time telling people what to do when they're in awe of the talent that they are. And, you know, so I did find that a little tough. But when it came back to me as the final, you know, piece, I actually, you know, like when let's take up Divinity. When I take up a Trevor and Ryan Wynn piece, you know, I know exactly what I want to do because I'm complimenting their work and Matt Kent's story. When it was stained, it actually took me a long time to figure out how I wanted to color it to best, you know, support the story because I was so close to it. And what happened was I had John Layman, who's a writer of Chew and some DC Comics Detective Run. He said, you know, like, you're being a moron, just color the book. And I kind of like laugh, and those words always went through my head every time I, you know, opened a page to color of Stain. It was like, you've been coloring for 20 years, just color it. Like, don't, you know, don't think about it so much just because you also wrote the book. And that was really good advice. And so like the first, you know, several pages took a real long time, but after that, you know, it was a natural flow. So, you know, it wasn't the plan for me to color, but at the same time, I'm glad I got to.
And you found the whole process to be pretty natural, like once you got in the flow of it, or did it still see, were there times you just had to be like, yeah, I wrote this. And so I was kind of the, you know, the seed of it, the beginning of it in my head. And now I'm kind of the last hands on it. By the end, did it feel natural, or did it still feel weird?
As a writer, it felt extremely natural, and I think it's going to. I think it shows, you know, to a lot of people, this is my first work that they'll ever read, you know, my writing, and so to them, they're going to see it as, you know, hopefully someone who seems to be writing, you know, for a long time, and because the truth is, I have been writing for a long time, and giving advice to other writers and things like that. It's just, this is my first published comic book work as a writer. And, you know, life is kind of funny that way, where you could do something for a long time and still have, you know, something else be a first. But writing, I had a writing partner, Neil Posner. He was a former editor at Wildstorm Studios. And he was a great, you know, writing partner. And I would bounce ideas off of him. And one of the things that made him great was, he would say things like, why? And a lot of people are like, well, that's an easy question to ask, but it's also when he asks, you know, that why. You know, it wasn't just a why for a why, because when he was saying these questions, he was helping me expand the story. He didn't create anything, he didn't write anything, you know, in terms of storyline. He might have suggested stuff just to kind of help me move the story along. Yet I would take all those notes and then, you know, do it my own way and send it back to him. He goes, perfect, now I understand. And that would help, you know, really bring completeness to the story in a way without talking down to any reader. Right? One of my biggest compliments I've got so far is I created a world without necessarily spelling out the world. I didn't have to tell everybody about every little thing. And one of the, you know, perks about comics is your show. You know, I get to go on shows like this, and we get to kind of talk a little bit deeper about the project and the world that, you know, created. So I don't have to necessarily write every little detail that people might wonder. So the writing process was super natural. It came quickly, it came easily. I don't think I had a single moment in the writing process where I was just bashing my head against the keyboard. I mean, there are some tough times where I'm like, okay, that's not good enough, or, you know, that's a good idea, but I can do better. But the story, you know, if I left it for a day or two, by the time it came back, it was there. And I think that's a lot to my credit of my writing process, where I'm all emotion first. You know, I go and I thumbnail the story from start to finish with words, you know. And if I get stuck, I'll just write fight scene, or I'll just write, you know, this scene's going to have, you know, this element mixed with this element. And then I'll move on to something I can write fuller. And so instead of it's just being page one to page 22, even though I start off that way, I jump around in the script as I'm fulfilling, you know, and pushing the story along. I'm able to, you know, create a very full, complete story that way. When it came to coloring, the process was also natural after I, you know, got over that hump of I'm coloring my own book. And that was, you know, that was difficult. But as soon as I got over that and I came up with my, you know, color scheme, much like I did with Divinity, Bloodshot, or Dr. Mirage, as soon as I came up with that color scheme, that color style that I wanted to complement Yusuf's work with, it came natural again and flowed pretty quickly.
Yeah, I actually read a few reviews from people that had read the story already before I even had a chance to read it. And it was one of the things I definitely agreed with, is that, like you said, getting that feedback of you're creating this world without, like, just having to have, like, blocks of text on, you know, like, you're able to, more so than a writer who hasn't been published before that I've seen, just able to drop little clues, and so it makes it seem natural. You're learning about the world, you're learning about the personality of the characters without having it, like, you know, spoon-fed to you, which is a mark of a really great writer, in my opinion. So kudos for that.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the book is filled with so many Easter eggs. I had to, like, pull back a bit, and, like, on issue two, where we're just proofing it, and I saw another Easter egg opportunity. And I talked to the project coordinator, James, at 451. I said, you know, how about putting one more in here? And he's like, well, that's cool, but only if you really, you know, really think so. It's not necessarily. And I didn't do it just because I didn't feel like it was a natural enough Easter egg, because it was an afterthought. Yeah. And everything, you know, about that book, you know, is a very natural telling to the story, you know, minus a couple, you know, Manchester United, you know, throw-ins here and there. Everything itself is about the story. I mean, the reread, after you, you know, read all five, you know, issues, going back to number one is going to give you a whole nother perspective to look at everything.
Another thing you said I found interesting is talking about jumping around, not necessarily writing the story in a linear fashion. Now, you know so many people in the industry, some real legendary creators. So I'm sure that you, you know, kind of picked their brains as you were going through the process of creating the story. Maybe times something wasn't working out right. You know plenty of people to reach out to. I haven't necessarily heard of anybody else taking this approach. Was that just something that came naturally to you, the idea to kind of jump around when you got stuck? Or had you known of other writers who'd done it?
So I only actually spoke to one professional writer besides my writing partner, Neil Posner, who is a professional writer, just not in comics. He was an editor, a lifelong fan of comics, and a very talented technical writer. The only writer I really, you know, kept asking advice for was John Layman, who's been a very close friend of mine for years. And, I when I gave him my first issue, he read it, which isn't an easy thing to do when you're a writer yourself and someone asks to read your script. It's not really the easiest thing to do, especially when it's a brand new writer, but, you know, he was gracious enough to do it. And, you know, if you know John Layman, you'll understand how this is a compliment, which is, he said, you know, after he read it, he goes, "David, let's see, how do I tell you this? It didn't suck." And so, you know, him telling me it didn't suck was his way of actually saying, you know, you got something. You know, this is a good thing. It's not perfect. You know, he gave me some suggestions here and there about punching up a couple things. And it wasn't even so much that I took those ideas, but I took the philosophy to heart. And I might have, you know, retooled it a little bit based off his suggestions. And I took those, you know, suggestions back to, you know, my writing partner. The biggest one, you know, was dialogue. You know, for me, you know, when we talk about learning curves, the story and the pacing is extremely easy to me. Like, I find that natural, you know, because it's something I've, you know, been doing my whole life. And but one thing I don't do, being a comic book, you know, person, is I don't, you know, do dialogue. It's not something that, you know, dialogue for a lot of us comes off, you know, super cheesy when we're writing it. And I knew that was going to be a learning curve on how to do it. And Layman's advice was, you know, to loosen up and don't think that the words that you're thinking are wrong. And because that's really what would happen. I would overthink dialogue and make them a lot stiffer than what it should be. And in reality, Stain should have Bond villains. You know, they should have, you know, good old classic villains, good old classic lines, and it's that action adventure sci-fi. You know, get my, you know, embrace my inner Indiana Jones, and you know, let the puns fly. And when I finally loosened up and didn't take my dialogue so serious, I was able to, you know, really help the dialogue along. And when the book gets serious, because it does take a dark, twisted turn where the book does get serious, those lines came out that much truer and that much more distinctive and at a higher contrast to the other lines that Emma, you know, speaks here and there. You know, this book, you know, one of the quotes that I got from one of the people that reviewed it was, "This book gave my girlfriend nightmares in all the right ways." And I just always laugh at that one, because he told me the story how his girlfriend woke up in the middle of the night, basically shaking him and saying, you know, "What happened to so-and-so character?" And I won't actually say it, because I don't want to, you know, spoil it, because they got, you know, a full five-issue review. That brings up the point also that all five issues are done. This book will be on time every time. One of the perks of the way I like to work, which is also rare, going back to your, you know, original question about how, you know, different it is from other, you know, writers, I had to write a complete story. I don't like to write an outline and to work my way to that outline issue by issue. I wanted to write the whole thing before Yusuf tackled it, or any artist tackled it, so they can really get the understanding of what's going to happen. And that's how there's so many Easter eggs in the reread, is because after I wrote all five issues, I was able to go back in and polish up some of the other scenes to give it even more depth. And some of this depth isn't necessarily called out in dialogue or action, but called out, you know, in subtle ways in the background. So I was lucky enough to switch it, unlike other artists. You know, I mean, Lemire wrote, you know, all 25 issues of Bloodshot Reborn. I don't know how much he went back in each issue. I don't know, you know, his process, but I do know, like, people like John Layman, who wrote, you know, this 60, you know, issue epic of Chew, you know, he wrote it, you know, he knew where he was going, but at the same time, he wrote it issue by issue. Even though I wrote this book issue by issue, in reality, I wrote, you know, a five-issue storyline, and then I then broke that five-issue storyline up into five parts to, you know, create the five issues, and then I fleshed out each part, And then after I fleshed out each part of each issue, was only then when I wrote, you know, the first issue. It wasn't issue one, then issue two, issue three. It was almost all together. And as far as I know, that's pretty unique as well. And I think the only reason I was able to do that was, you know, this was not a planned, you know, project. This was a personal project that, you know, was originally self-funded. And, you know, with that said, I treated it a lot more like a script for a movie than a comic book, even though it was always intended to be a comic book, and the writing showed that through panel descriptions and pacing.
Well, we've talked a lot about the process and why you decided to do this. Let's talk a little bit specifically about the story itself. Now, obviously, we don't want to give too much away, because we want everyone to go out there this Wednesday to their local comic shop, May 3rd, and pick up a copy of Stained for themselves. But just to kind of give an idea to the listeners of what Stained is all about.
Stained is a sci-fi adventure. It's set in a slight futuristic alternative universe like our own. So it has a lot of similarities. But what happened was, and this doesn't really get spelled out too much in the actual book. I like to keep people, you know, filling a lot of info with their own imagination. But it seemed like a lot of people picked up on this really easily, which was good. There was a plague of some type of disease that affected a good majority of the population. And to save the population, because it was, you know, that many people, and it would be too catastrophic to lose that many people, they knew that they could slice off limbs and put prosthetics on them. And the rich got nanotechnology and carbon fiber and synthetic flesh put over their prosthetics. And the poor couldn't afford it, yet, you know, the rich need a workforce. They got big old clunky metal, oily prosthetics, and they were referred to as stains because they, you know, could actually leave a stain on your couch. I always think about this scene in Coming to America. I know it's kind of an older movie. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Yep. You hear that laugh already, where, you know, the family that, you know, owns Soul Glow, you know, leans against the couch, and their Jerry Curl, you know, stains against the couch. And I love that movie so much, and I was thinking about that every time. And I almost, you know, it's almost kind of the same thing. Yet, with this world, you know, they're really looked down. You know, in Coming to America, those, you know, that family was extremely rich, and so it's kind of the opposite in this world, where have to, you know, find different jobs if you look that way. Now, Emma's our hero, and a little nice little side note for your listeners, Emma London is her full name, and Emma London would have been my daughter's name if I did not have a boy. So me and my wife had a child, and we were waiting till he was born, and she picked out the boy name, and I picked out the girl name, and it came out a boy. So his name is Michael instead of Emma, and so that's how I came up with the character's name, because I liked that name so much. I was like, all right, someone has to be called Emma London. So in a way, you know, that's, you know, very special to me. But going back to the story, you know, so it's set in that little world where, you know, she's already looked down, you know, on the, you know, you'll see in issue one that the police don't even like her. She really only has one friend. You know, Emma is a lot like me, where she can be very social, yet at the same time, being social sometimes makes her very uncomfortable until she gets to know someone. And then it's kind of like, you know, that kid who's always quiet. As soon as you get that kid to start talking, you can't get him to be quiet. You know, again, you know, sometimes that's me. You know, the more excited I get, the more I talk. You know, the more I like, you know, the person I'm talking to, the more rambunctious I am. And but until that moment, I'm that silent guy sitting in the corner of the bar, you know, alone. And that's kind of Emma. And, you know, she, because of, you know, her class status, she's just trying to, you know, make a buck and pay her rent, you know. And so, you know, you can call her a bounty hunter. I kind of like to call her a recovery artist because she just kind of goes after, you know, lost or stolen things. You just kind of get to meet her and see what she's about. And when the story, you know, gets rolling, you get to see kind of how she reacts to the situation. And, you know, the one thing I really like about Emma is that, you know, some people describe her fearless. It's not that she's, you know, fearless. She definitely has fears, but she also has responsibility. And I think that's what, you know, every great hero has, is that responsibility to do what's right.
Would you say it's her against the world? I know she's part of this underclass, this stained subclass, as it were. And she is, you know, pretty much on her own, as you said. She just has kind of one friend. So in a way, I kind of got the vibe that it was like kind of her against the world. But at the same time, I also kind of felt like she's part of something bigger. And maybe we'll see that as the story unfolds. What can you say about that?
I would say it's more that she is against the world, you know, even though that's not the intent, you know, like, I would say she's just trying to live in the world, you know, like she's not trying to be against it. The world's against her and she wishes it wasn't, you know, cause it makes her life difficult. If she could have a, you know, cushy job in an office, she probably would love it, you know, even though nowadays, you know, it probably, you know, make her go insane because of the lifestyle that she was kind of forced to lead. But, you know, it's more that the world's against her, and so she's just trying to live in it. I mean, one of my favorite quotes was from, you know, Robert Venditti, and he just said, she's just trying to pay her rent, you know, and it's so true. It really you know, kind of sums her up that, you know, she's just trying to live in this world that hates her. And sure, not everyone hates her, but, like, in the opening scene, you know, there's a criminal that, you know, that's talking to her that has a bounty on his head, and he's insulting her because he thinks he's better than her. I mean, that's how low, you know, her status is in this world. And it's just like, you know, another guy, you know, that, you know, is just trying to, you know, take it out on her. And yet, you know, she'll come out on top. And, just because she keeps pushing and she keeps trying to live in this world, she's not giving up. And she remembers, you know, her life, you know, before, you know, her enhancements or prosthetics. I like to call them enhancements, because the truth is, I feel that, you know, this took away a selfishness, you know, that people have of vanity. And, you know, as I joke around with people, yet, you know, in every joke, there's a lot of truth. I always tell people how vain I am. And people, like, laugh when I say that. But I tell them, I go, like, I don't want a bad picture of me on the internet. You know, I don't want, you know, something stuck in my, you know, teeth as I'm talking to, you know, a piece of food stuck in my teeth as I'm talking to someone. And, you know, I don't want to leave the house, you know, in an outfit that, you know, someone might think is sloppy or, you know, outdated. And so with that, I kind of consider that vain. And she's kind of was forced not to be vain. You know, I think as a woman or a man who has, you know, most of their body removed, you know, that can do two things. That can make you either self-conscious or you can kind of accept it and remove, you know, vanity from our plate. And I would say this book only has a couple real life topics, and for her, you know, I think the first one is responsibility. What, you know, what do you do when, you know, when life throws something at you that you don't want to? And you know, the crazy part is, you know, I'm doing a little of that right now in my own life. You know, I do some charity work and you know, during the charity work that we discovered that, you know, there might be some corruption, you know, in this charity where the money's not going to where it is. You know, at that point, you know, what do? You know, do you actually, you know, take the long, hard process and take away a part of your own life to help out the cause, or do you just walk away? And you know, that's where Emma, you know, steps up and says, no, I have a responsibility to, you know, help, you know, this person out. So I think for her, what people should get out of the story is responsibility. Yet there in the world itself, I think, is a commentary on vanity in a subtle way. I'm not going to say it's ever in your face. It's never. I don't write to have a political agenda. That's not who I am. I wrote to have a really good story, really fun read. But with that, when you give someone a complete story, messages and morals, and morals of a story start to come into play. And I think those are the two that, really stand out to me.
You mentioned she thinks back to the times before she had the prosthetics, the enhancements. Did you have time in this 5-issue story to really spend some time exploring her past? Or
none.
Is that something that...
Yeah, absolutely none. So, beginning of the interview, I told you I had 12 issues. And in those 12 issues, there are some that there was... those 12 issues were 4-issue story arcs. So it was kind of broken up where I had... a story, basically a flashback story of how she, came to be, and how she was enhanced more than, some of the other counterparts, because she is able to do a couple more things than others, and it kind of breaks into, why she can do those things, but in this 5-issue story, there's no room to dive into her past. There just isn't to give. Like, if I would have done that, it would have taken away from, what the story was. And that's why issue one is so important to the story, because that is the base of who she is. You get to know her, you get to know the world. And then after that, I ignore the world, because you don't want it in your face. You want it, you just want to be in it. And that's what I feel I accomplished. Now we're just in her world, and we're not calling out, new technologies or political commentary. In the 12-issue run, which had the ongoing, involved, I had a whole political commentary of society, on the class system. Now, as I just said, there's really two commentaries, and that's responsibility and vanity. And people are like, well, what about the obvious class system? And that's really just the world. That's not really the story. But in the original, outline, that was definitely in there. So we don't have time, sadly, to dive into it. Hopefully the book and, people will love the character. People will love, the whole story. They'll enjoy my writing. They'll enjoy Yusuf's art and Simon Boland's lettering. Enough to buy the book so much where 451 will be like, we have to make another run. They know I have two more arcs already basically ready to go. I need to polish them up a little bit because it's been so long since I looked at them. But we have more of her story to get to know her a little bit more, to get to know the world a little bit more. Played in there, but as this 5 issues, most of it is going to be answered in sessions like this, like podcasts, panels, at conventions, and hopefully future stories. But in this 5-issue, no. I mean, sadly, it's the number one request. I want to know more. I want to know more. But instead, they're going to get a thrill ride.
Right on. One thing you haven't mentioned, I find it interesting because I think it's not necessarily a theme or something you set out to explore. I kind of sense this about the story, but it's almost inherent in the world that you've set up here, right? So, and it goes again to the class system. So maybe not a theme of the story, but again, kind of a theme of the setting or the world or just the way humanity has evolved, right? That's what does it mean to be human? If you've had more than 50%, more than 70%, more than 80% of your body replaced with prosthetics or enhancements or whatever you want to call them, are you now more machine than human? Does that does that make you lesser? Does it not? How does it affect you emotionally and how other people see you? And I find that questions like that, philosophies and things like that, I mean, I always say that comics that make you think are my favorite kind of comics. And I mean, we can talk at length about thousands of different things in our own world that can affect you emotionally, and whether that makes you less than human. You know, if you're a psychopath or a sociopath, what does that mean as you relate with relationships and everything? And so, like, automatically, I mean, I didn't know what to expect. I purposely, when you and I had talked about having you come on the show and talk about this book, I didn't try to pick your brain about too much, because I wanted it to be new and fresh when I got a chance to read it. And right away, when I saw her and I realized that she in a way was something less than human, you know, she's less than 100% human, she's less than 100% naturally human, however you want to put it, automatically I'm in, because I want to try to identify with her. I want to try to see where she's coming from. And, you know, right from the first page, as you said, when this guy, this dreg of society, this criminal, even looks down on her, automatically there's something interesting, and it gives you something to think about. I'm sure you weren't even conscious of that, but has anyone else brought that up to you, or now that the story's kind of getting out there?
No, I mean, it's a great point, and it's definitely something that I've thought about, where, again, you know, the world is against her, and we talk about, you know, towards the later, you know, pages of the scene, you know, there's a scene with her in her kitchen, and I think that plays to exactly what you're talking about, is, you know, she remembers, quote-unquote, being, you know, fully human. And it's not like RoboCop. It's not like where he's so machine, you know, the brain's programmed and things like that. She has her soul. She has her thoughts. She has her brain. She has what made herself her. No one's trying to reprogram her or anyone else in this world. So with that said, you know, you still feel human, yet it does challenge, you know, your definition of human. Because, you know, she still, you know, still has those human qualities that what makes a human, you know, tick, and what makes us, you know, feel and think. You know, there's still a desire to have friends. There's still a desire, you know, to have a good meal, and still a desire to look, you know, pretty. And I say that, you know, both as for men and women, you know, like you still want to look cool. In the opening bar scene, you know, there's two, you know, quote unquote stains in the background. The whole bar is filled with them. And, you know, those stains in the background are meant to be, you know, young and hip. You know, they're supposed to be, you know, people that if someone, you know, saw those two walking across, the bar, you know, they might give them a nice little look, you know, as like, oh, those two cool guys are cool, you know. And, but with, you know, Emma, it's not always that way, even though, you know, readers and fans who's, you know, had sneak peeks or little, you know, snippets of who Emma is have already identified with her. And I think that's why it's human. I mean, people look at her and, you know, she's there sipping on a Jack and Coke, you know, in the bar. And, you know, it doesn't matter if she can drink or not. It's the fact that, you know, she's just kind of there thinking about it. And, you know, people identify with that. They don't always feel pretty. You know, people, like I said, are quite vain. And how would they feel if, you know, they were, you know, part machine? Could they hide behind it? Could they embrace it? You know, or would it really disturb them and make them feel less human? I think when we read the book, we're going to find that Emma is very human. And what makes her human is that responsibility, is that, you know, commitment to doing what she feels is right, no matter how people look at her. And I think that's, you know, one of the pluses of the story. You know, I actually had a person who had prosthetics a while back, you know, tell me, oh, you know, so she's going to be like me. And I was like, huh? You know, like, and I didn't even really get the connection that, you know, in this world, you know, there are several people that are considered, you know, disabled or handicapped because of, you know, their, you know, prosthetics. And I think there's a lot to think about that. I think, you know, when you think about a war veteran who does have, you know, a prosthetic arm and leg, or two legs, or two, you know, all four, you know, limbs, you know, how do they feel? You know, what are they thinking, you know, today on how people perceive them. Whenever I see someone with a missing leg, and I had a very close, a friend who has a missing leg, at first it took a while to get used to it, but then getting to know him, you can realize, look, life is tough. You know, you got to roll with it. And the only way that we're going to make them feel less of a person is if we treat them like less of a person. And I think that's what you picked up a lot in this story is the fact that people are treating Emma as less of a person. And it's only because of her, you know, as I say, enhancements, you know, it's only because she is different than, you know, what they are. And, or if they have these same enhancements, they're rich enough to cover them up with synthetic flesh, or at least have very fine, you know, lined, prosthetics that are carbon fiber and nanotechnology based, depending on, you know, their need. I think you really, you know, brought up a good point to, you know, what I was trying to accomplish, which was not spell out too many things, for the fact that if you spell everything out, you're hurting the reader's imagination. And as a fan of comics myself, that is one of the worst things you can do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, give us something to think about and give us room to think about it. But yeah, I mean, that scene in the kitchen for me, I saw that and my reaction was just like, oh, that sucks. You know, something I didn't even think about till I saw it. And then I was just like, oh man.
Yeah. I mean, then you call it back to when she was, you know, you can call it back on a reread to the opening scene.
Yep.
And there you go. And then you can, in issue two, there's going to be another scene that, you know, kind of, you know, has another element, you know, of that makes you, if you read into the story, you know, give it a reread sometimes so it you know, goes back into your, you know, mind, you're going to see a lot of struggles that Emma goes through that can go back to your point, is she human? And the truth is, she is human. The question is, does she get treated like a human, and a person that should have instant respect and rights as a person. And you know, that is a very hidden line that goes throughout the story. However, you know, it's such an underlined element that, again, you know, I find Stained available on many different layers. You know, I think a young person who isn't as thoughtful and deep, you know, because of their, you know, innocence, could still enjoy this as a action adventure sci-fi. And then I think a young adult could, you know, come up with some of the, you know, graphic images and get some emotional reaction. And then I find that a more mature crowd could actually read into all the things that you and I have been talking about.
Yeah, there's one more layer, if you will. And again, I think it's not necessarily something you're aware of, because, you know, you said yourself you didn't want to make it, you know, too political. You know, something had to give when you're cutting it down from 12 issues to 5. But especially in the current real-world political climate, the whole idea of the haves and the have-nots, and you certainly can draw that comparison here to the, you know, as you've mentioned several times, you know, the rich that can afford to look more human than the stained. And, you know, it's that whole class thing again. And I think it's part of what's so important about telling stories. I think it's part of how you can, I don't want to say judge a society, but you can get a window into a society in the fiction that they tell, in the stories that they tell, in the way the relationships. When they tell a story, what are the relationships? How do they have society interact with itself? You can learn a lot, I think, about a civilization by looking to their stories. And by having a story like this that has all these layers, you know, the emotion, what it means to be human, the world is against her, and then the class system, the have and the have-nots.
Well, you're right. I mean, it definitely, there is another part of the world itself, even though this isn't necessarily I take that back. The have and the have-nots is a consistent theme throughout the book. In fact, one could argue after reading all five issues, that is the main theme of the book, that my sense of responsibility and my sense of vanity is me personally reading into my own work, where in reality, the story is all about the haves and the have-nots. And I can't go in too much, to that, because it will spoil some of the story. So you and I have to, have a podcast conversation at the end of the fifth issue, so we can just talk literally about the haves and have-nots, and if that truly is the overall, message of the book. But let's just take the first issue, that's coming out. There's a scene in there where, she goes and she gets, some reward money, and they take out a ton of taxes. And, there's a lot of people that have some reviews, online, didn't actually read the book. They just heard about a review and the tax situation, and they thought how unrealistic it was. And we actually, me and Neil, talked because he thought it was very unrealistic too to have such a high tax. And I said, it's coming again from personal experience. I go, well, if you're self-employed, you hit a certain, tax bracket, you get a lot of your taxes taken out. And then you get on top of that, another 7% being self-employed, and you're starting going up and up. And that's without a government, or world that had to, put a bunch of, healthcare to keep humanity alive, where's that money going to come from? Do you think the rich and powerful are going to pay for everyone's well-being?
Heck.
Or they're going to save you and they're going to just charge you later? Yep. I mean, let's be honest, even in today's world, as you brought up, there's no way, people are going to pay, in today's climate, for everyone's healthcare. I mean, it's a huge, battle. But what happens if they were forced to pay for everyone's healthcare? What happens then? Who are they going to tax when they are forced to pay for everyone's healthcare? They're going to tax themselves, or are they going to tax the people that needed the healthcare? So, but that goes again why, I am agreeing with you about, the haves and haves not. The have nots, anytime they, can potentially get a have, that gets taxed so much that they still are a have not.
When we're done here, we'll talk a little bit more about that. I have a book I want to bring up to you, see if you've heard of it. But the setting itself, we've talked quite a bit about the world. Were you conscious of that when you were creating, that you wanted the future and the setting to be its own character, or did that just happen naturally as you were kind of fleshing out the story?
I wanted it to be its own character. Every story I've ever created, the environment is always its own character. I think that's because of the stories that I love. If you actually think about all the great movies out there that I've always enjoyed, going back from Goonies to something like Monsters Incorporated, the world is important. The world that they live in is important, because that's your setting. And I think every good story has to have a setting first. I think there's a lot of movies. Let's take a recent one, and I'm not here to badmouth or bash or be a troll, but just in my honest opinion, let's take Suicide Squad. I was not a fan, and Suicide Squad, the movie, I think part of the reason that I didn't enjoy watching it was there was no world that they lived in. It was just a generic place after generic place, so you didn't have to care about the city, that they were trying to quote unquote save. You didn't have to care about anything. And I think the first thing a good movie does is helps you understand the environment that your heroes live in. And when you can understand the environment your heroes live in, you're able to understand your hero that much better. I mean, even take a movie like Leon the Professional. Do you remember that movie at all?
Of course.
So the very opening, we get to see what type of environment, Natalie Portman's and Leon the Professional, Matilda and Leon the Professional's characters live in. It's a very corrupt, harsh, raw, a city. And you don't have to know much about it to really get the vibe of it, you just gotta, you know, get to know it just a little bit. You gotta be introduced to it just a little bit. And whenever I write a story, the first thing I really write about is the location. You know, where does it take place? Why is this place, you know, special? One of the first stories I ever wrote was called Twisted City, and I hope one time to show it. It's this weird, you know, carny type of ride, and you know, about youth. Kind of think of like Lost Boys, but instead of vampires, it's just, you know, high schoolers traveling through a carnival, and but the city is a Spanish name, but it translates into Twisted, and so it was called Twisted City, and you know, the city was definitely a character. And so with Stained, we're in Sinner City, which is highly, highly generic, highly, you know, superhero, you know, type of name. But I wanted to identify it. You know, I didn't need to spend, you know, all this time to give it super meaning. Besides, you know, this is the Sinner City of you know, the location, and it's giving you, you know, a name to go with the place. And the little pieces that Yusuf, you know, brought to it were excellent and were important, because, you know, later in the story, you know, we travel out of this town to another town, and I actually give you the mileage. I don't give you names. I give you mileage of where we're traveling, and someone can look it up I'm sure they will, you know. Someone will, you know, try to guess where Sinner City is based off of and where the next location is based off mileage. And, it, you know, it's a simple map quest, you know, go. And I think people who know me, you know, will figure it out, you know, if they wanted to. But, you know, it's those little things that give it life. So is it, you know, was it designed to be a main character? Not by any means. And I don't think it does. I think it's just helps you identify a little bit more about Emma and who she is from where she lives.
Now, did you find when you were setting up, well, a couple things really, when you were setting up the location as the writer and then having someone else really kind of put their spin on it through their pencils and illustration, and then you got to go back and set the mood with the color. So that had to be a little bit different process and experience for you as well, because I know one of the things you pride yourself on as a color artist is setting the mood and being so versatile that you set the mood, and the mood is very different from story to story and book to book. You know, something like The Secret Life of Dr. Mirage, for example, you know, much darker, much more noirish than like Archer and Armstrong, where the colors are brighter because the mood is just more playful, right? So was it setting the mood and it kind of having more control over it, but then having this outside perspective from Yusuf, was that a different experience for you?
Well, with Yusuf, I gave him a lot of reference, and a lot of good writers, you know, always attach reference because it helps, you know, share kind of what they're trying to create. And luckily, you know, I'm an artist myself. I draw a lot, and you know, nowhere near as talented as Yusuf, but I was able to really guide him to the story and an area that I thought, you know, she lived in. I was able to design, you know, almost every character, you know, first, and then, you know, get his take on them second. And one of the things, you know, that was definitely a thought was, what does the city look like? You know, what are my, you know, futuristic touches to it that gives it a slight, you know, futuristic feel, but yet still a believable world that we live in? And and you know, what should be taken and what shouldn't, to be you know, to keep it based in reality. You gotta have a story based in reality, otherwise you're gonna lose people instantly. I mean, even something like Avatar, you know, as crazy as that, you know, movie is, from, you know, being in a completely different, you know, solar system galaxy, it was still believable because the way they set it up as a travel to a different place, you know, and that's believable to us. And so then now we were able to appreciate and accept this world that, you know, is has characteristics of our own, yet so drastically different. And with Stain, you know, I did the same thing. You know, it's so much, in fact, that landlords, the bar that you get to go to in the very opening of the scene, very opening of the book, that's actually a bar I used to, you know, frequent in my younger days. And even it being a corner bar with that martini glass in the window, that's literally was referenced from the bar that I used to, you know, go to as a young man. And including the bouncer that's sitting outside the bar. The bar had no signs, no nothing besides a little martini glass and a guy, you know, that a lot of times would stand outside to check IDs, and that was like the only way you even knew it was a bar. And sometimes that light wouldn't even be on, but people still knew where to go. So there's a lot of me in this project. So there's a lot of things that help make it a very identifiable, you know, world to the reader, because a lot of these places all had real effects on my life. They're real locations. You know, kind of think of it as, if you ever seen the movie Shakespeare in Love, how, you know, all of his writings were around him. He just kind of pulled from his life. Except that was, you know, fiction, and I'm actually pulling from my, you know, day-to-day experiences, you know, from the last 20 years.
If you had to say where you drew inspiration from the story, you know, being that it's sci-fi, did you find yourself, as you were writing it, realizing that you were referencing things that you were a fan of as, you know, growing up, being a fan of comics and sci-fi, or was it more like you felt like it was coming from within?
It was definitely coming from within, but what I found out when I completed the story, like, I remember sitting in bed one day and you know, talking to my wife, and I said, "Holy smokes, I just wrote, you know, such and such. I don't want to say it because I don't want to spoil anything." And she was like, "What do you mean?" And I described, you know, the story, you know, in a way that really paralleled it, you know, to this other project, you know, that I loved as a child. And I was like, "Don't get me wrong, like, it's a completely different take on it." And so I think my influence came through in the writing, yet as I'm writing it, I had no clue that they were there. And I think as a new writer who does not want to be compared to other projects, I was even more aware to not do that. And yet, who I am and my influence of my life, you know, came through. I mean, it's been you know, talked about as compared to Blade Runner, Ghost in the Shell, and, you know, both of those were the furthest from my mind when I was writing this book. I mean, absolutely the furthest, you know, from my mind. And again, when we talk again after issue 5, I'll tell you some of the, you know, thoughts that were in my mind of what I was looking for. And so it was quite interesting how, you know, Blade Runner and Ghost in the Shell has, you know, been brought up. Yet, you know, what I was thinking, you know, it was completely on a different, you know, genre of movies, and, you know, from influences of, you know, my childhood. So that'll be an interesting conversation. And it's always interesting to see what people think, you know, when I know that 451, being a movie studio, production company, you know, connections with Michael Bay, you know, as soon as they heard, you know, that, you know, quote, they're like, "Oh, that's great," you know, and then when they got the Ghost in the Shell one, "Oh, that's perfect," you know. So it's one of those things that, you know, kind of make me chuckle, you know, because again, I think Emma has qualities that make both of those properties something that, you know, people think of fondly, and yet I think at the same time, when you actually compare both of Emma's story and Stained and the other two properties, they're actually quite different.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see if I'll be able to pick up, once I've read all 5, be able to pick up on what it was that you feel like it kind of came through at the end without even realizing. Now, you mentioned you had some other stories that you've been itching to tell. Any plans for that? Are you too busy? Are you going to kind of see how this plays out?
So, well, you know, the great news is this. We already have stay number one sold out. You know, so it's already playing out well. The issue doesn't come out till for 2 days. We're talking on a Monday. It comes out this Wednesday on the May 3rd. And we heard this morning that it was already sold out at Diamond.
Wow, congratulations, man. That's huge.
It is huge. It really is. You know, there's been a lot of hard work, and I cannot be, you know, happier that the hard work paid off, because it wasn't easy. A lot of people think, okay, you've been in comics for, you know, 20 plus years. You doing your own book is a cakewalk. And people that know my process know that getting Stain made was anything but a cakewalk. It was a lot of hours and a lot of my own resources backing it to show people that I believed in the project so they could actually see it. No one was going to look at this book, you know, in script form, no matter, you know, how good it was. And, you know, me being in comics for a long time, it did not make it any easier for someone to actually take a look at the pitch. So with that, you know, having a sellout happen was just amazing. I mean, having Jock do the variant cover for the book was a huge help. I can't thank him enough. I can't thank any of the, you know, variant cover artists enough. All friends of mine, and all have done amazing work. And I think it was, you know, that effort as a whole, you know, from a lot of different people I've met through the years, including yourself, you know, all the support you've given me through my Valiant work, and you know, at the same time when you found out about my personal project, it wasn't like, oh, okay, you're writing now, that's cool, and then walk away. It was a sincere, you like me for my past work and our interactions, you're going to give this a shot. And I think when people actually gave it a shot, that's when the book took off, and I had to give away and write a lot of personal emails for a lot of review copies. But you know, that's what you have to do to get a book like this seen. You know, 451 is a new company. They've only been around for a little bit more than a year, and they're small. You know, when it comes to their comic book, you know, line, that doesn't mean that they put out bad books. It just means that they're small. And you know, with that said, it takes a lot of, you know, eyes to you know, get a book like Stain seen. We, you know, but now it's on all the hot lists. You know, now it's the one book that, you know, you want to find, even if it's on eBay. You know, the last week, you know, eBay sales went up from, you know, cover price to, you know, $20 an issue. And it's just like one of those rides that you just, you know, think is unreal. And, you know, I'm still kind of waiting to wake up on it. So, you know, for more storylines, I can't wait. You know, whether it's Stained or my next project, I actually have two more stories that I want to write, and that aren't Stained related. I plan to find the time to do those because it's really what I want to do. I love coloring. I will never stop coloring. I've lined up some, you know, some good projects in the near future, and but at the same time, I'm already talking to editors and companies about my next project.
Well, as far as me wanting to have you on the show to talk about this, I mean, personal feelings aside, you know, we're friends. That's what it is. When I have a chance to talk to creators who are as passionate and hardworking about their work as you, it's a no-brainer. You know, it's like whenever I have Scott Snyder on. You know, I remember when he talked at WonderCon the year before, WonderCon 2016. They had the big DC Rebirth announcement and everything. And, you know, I talked to him about his upcoming All-Star Batman, and he flat out told me on the show, you know, I know I could have kept doing Batman, and it wouldn't have been a big stretch. You know, for lack of a better term, I could have phoned it in and kept getting a really good paycheck, but that's not who I am. And I feel it's the same way with you. You know, you're never going to phone it in. If you take a project, it's because you believe in it. If you work for a company like Valiant, like 451, yeah, they're small, but it's quality over quantity. That says something, you know. to not just want to phone it in or to always want to do your best and to make the sacrifices to make that happen. I mean, for me, I'm always going to support people like that because the passion comes through in the work, and then I get to read awesome stories. So I'm so happy. Congratulations on the sellout. I'll tell all our listeners, you better get out there early on Wednesday to pick it up because it's going to be a hard find. And if you don't manage to get yourself a copy, it's going to be available digitally, David?
Yeah, it'll be on Comixology. You know, if you don't find yourself a copy, make sure you tweet at 451. I believe it's 451_official or no underscore, depending on what social media you are. But find 451 and let them know you did not have a copy and you want one. I've had a lot of stores that have already called me and said, because I've offered a lot of posters and things like that and said, hey, we've actually sold out of every issue that we ordered already on a pre-sale. And I just am so flattered and floored about the reception. If you can't find it, let me know. Let 451 know. We're going to find you a copy.
And not only that, be sure that you tell the store that you're on for the whole series so they can, get on that pre-order list. Make sure – yeah, maybe you'll miss out on the first issue, but make sure you're not missing out on the subsequent issues. Make sure you let them know, hey, I'm not just here for the first issue because I think it might be worth something down the road. It's a story that's quality and I want to read it. Order me a copy, put me down, whatever you need to do. Give them your number, whatever. Stores, it's a thin margin for comic stores these days, So anytime you can pre-order something, let them know you're interested. It really helps them out. So again, I want to thank David for joining me. I think we gave you a lot to think about. Read the book for yourself. Come back, listen to the podcast again. You'll probably get more out of it. And as David said, more perspective on the reread once all five issues are out. Certainly looking forward to having a few more people join us. Next time I have you on, we talk about Stained. Maybe we'll get a little round table going, talk about the story when it's all over. It was a blast. Can't wait to see you again. Are you going to be at Phoenix Comic Con?
I will definitely be at Phoenix. I can't wait.
All right. We'll see you then. So thanks for joining us, everybody. Please visit us at thecomicsourceblog.com for past episodes of the podcast. You can watch episodes of our YouTube channel there as well as finding links to Manny's written blog and my written blog and, of course, our famous sketch gallery. Be sure you're following us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Also do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram. Those are really the best two places to keep up to date on new episodes and convention coverage. Don't forget about our exclusive podcast in partnership with LRM Online. That's the 9-panel grid. You can go to lrmonline.com to enjoy new episodes every Tuesday, covering a variety of topics. That podcast is tends to be a little more toward the beginner collector, I'll say. We don't quite go into in-depth as we do here on the Comic Source. So if you know somebody that might want to listen to that, be sure and recommend it. We really appreciate it. So once again, I want to thank David for joining me, and we'll talk to you next time.